This is the Education Gadfly Show.
We were labeled as libertarian centrist. I've got to believe that the folks at Cato were just up in arms over labeling us that way.
Well, it's all the writing you guys have been doing about drug legalization.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man purported to be at the center of the education sector phone hacking scandal, Bill Tucker.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
Good. Welcome to the show.
Oh, wow. My bona fides are under investigation right now.
Exactly. I should tell our listeners, we are taping this on a Monday, which is unusual for us, a little early in the week. I don't know by the time this comes out whether it will be appropriate to joke about the hacking scandal. Just today there was news about somebody showing up dead who was in the middle of this thing, right? Have you heard about this? Seriously, people looking at me like nobody's heard about this. Do you guys not get, do you know the news? Twitter? Anybody? Anyways, this thing is getting kind of weird, but yeah, big scandal. And I guess you guys are careful not to do any phone hacking in the education sector.
You know, we've been very careful to stay away from that. We were going to do a partnership with Scotland Yard, but we backed out of it because they just didn't pass our integrity test.
Yes, good. I think that is quite appropriate. So Bill, joining us from education sector, thanks for pitching in. You know, we had Richard Coleman on the show not too recently ago. Is this some kind of new Fordham ed sector conspiracy?
Yeah, I think we're dragging you into the rational mainstream here, mm-hmm. away from your sometimes a little too far extreme.
Well, I thought you might say that. She'll be glad to know that Josh, who's here with us today, going to ask the questions. He is a Koch fellow. That's right. Paid for by the Koch brothers.
Oh.
How do you like that, huh?
Oh, I thought you were going to be a Coca-Cola fellow.
No. Come on. Get it. So unless you're paid for by George Soros in some way, I think we still have, I think we have a right-wing bona fides in shape. You know, it is funny. I mean, so Fordham and ed sector, we tend to agree on lots of things, kind of mainstream education reform thinking at this point, and where we differ, there's some ideological basis for it, but not always. But and yet, you guys are considered lefties, and we're considered on the right. I don't know. People like their labels. They like their boxes.
They do, but there's this recent study of how think tanks are portrayed in the media, and we were labeled as libertarian centrist. I've got to believe that the folks at Cato were just up in arms over labeling us that way.
Well, it's all the writing you guys have been doing about drug legalization. So I guess that's what kicked into that libertarian box. All right. Well, hey, lots to cover on education. There is it's summertime, but education does not slow down. Those days are long past. A lot happening. So we will play Pardon the Gadfly and get into the current events. We will then hear from Daniela with the Research Minute, in place of Amber, who's on vacation. Now, listeners, don't tune out right now. I know that everybody loves Amber's segment, but Daniela's going to bring it. Okay, yeah. So stay in there. And then finally, we've got Chris Irvine's What's Up With That? So let's get started and play Pardon the Gadfly. Josh, kick us off.
Thanks, Mike. DCPS announced the firings of 206 teachers on Friday, 141 of whom were let go for being rated minimally effective 2 years in a row. What's the national significance?
So what do you think, Bill? This is a pretty big deal here. We've got Michelle Rhee is gone, and yet the impact system is still around. And we're actually laying off teachers for poor performance.
We
it's crazy.
Are. It is absolutely crazy. 3 years from now, would this be news?
Well, this is the thing. So DC is still an anomaly here, right? Can you think of another big district that's doing this? That's
not at this level.
No.
But it's in process.
Yeah.
And I think what we're learning in DC, clearly impact is not perfect. My colleague Susan Hedden just spent about 3 to 6 months investigating, talking with teachers, visiting master educators, and there are things that can be improved in the system. But we focus so much on the number of teachers that were laid off, but fewer than 10%. This isn't some crazy scheme. It's getting better, and I think at some point it's somewhat normal. I think what's kind of interesting is the fact that this is such news, mm-hmm. that a teacher actually happens to lose their job, not because they were crazy or abusive to children or got in trouble with the law, but just because they didn't do their job well enough.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see if I suspect this number will go down over time, that each year there may be fewer teachers fired because you would think the system's going to get better at hiring people in the first place who are able to meet these standards and doing the professional development and all that kind of stuff. It'll be hard to know whether that's the case or whether they're just watering things down. I am curious, and I haven't seen this, about how this plays out in terms of some of the racial politics that surrounded Michelle Rhee. You know, to what, how many of these teachers were white versus black? How many were younger versus older? Have you seen anything on that yet?
I haven't. The only thing that we've seen are that the highly effective teachers continue to be concentrated in Ward 3 in the wealthier areas of the city, and the Ward 7s and 8, the poor areas of the city continue to have fewer highly effective teachers, at least by impact. So there's this question about teacher distribution, or should the standards be different? Mm-hmm. Is it a greater, you know, degree of difficulty? Should there be some kind of degree of difficulty measure mm-hmm. in teaching in a more difficult population? That seems to be one of the issues going on here.
But you cannot overstate the importance of this. This has been sort of the holy grail for years in education reform. It's the basic good government notion that says, hey, we should identify teachers that are not performing well. After they get help, they still don't perform well, we should get them out of the classroom. And we have been unable to do that anywhere until now in D.C. I think Michelle Rhee deserves a lot of credit for that. Go, Michelle. Okay, topic number two.
The Sunday Times had a big piece about the backlash to planned charter schools in the affluent New Jersey suburbs. Are charter critics right that such schools have no place in good districts?
I love these kinds of questions that we set up on the show. No, they're not right. Of course they're not right. This is ridiculous. I wrote about this week a little bit. Look, there's this group in New Jersey that's trying to fight a charter school that wants to come in that's going to do Mandarin immersion as their approach. You know, the argument is that, hey, our school district's great. We have great test scores. Everything's going fine. You know, we shouldn't allow these selfish parents, and the guy called them selfish, selfish parents to come in and provide a customized education for their children at the taxpayer's expense. Like, where was this guy like in the 1970s? What is this? Come on, choice is now a part of American public education. We take that almost as a given, and the notion is very simple. It says we shouldn't force parents, affluent or not, to have to go to the private system in order to get a school that meets their values and their desires and is a good fit for their kid. So, and, you know, to the extent that we can, we should provide options within the public school system that parents are excited about.
So on one level, I agree. This seems pretty outdated philosophy of thinking this way. But if we abstract up just one bit, we're really dealing with two sort of conflicting but deeply held American values, one of individuality and one of equality. And so if you read this article about the New Jersey school, there's this sense that we're all in together, we all go to the common school, we have a common experience, shared sacrifice.
Blah, blah, blah. Yes.
But Mike, no, those are long-held American tenets.
Yes,
and at the same time, no matter the best school, could you say that 100% of the students there are all doing perfectly well? There obviously always needs to be some way to offer something different. Even getting back to the original concept of charter schools as places for innovation.
Right. No, and that's right. I mean, what a lot of parents are going to want is they're going to want a neighborhood school, first of all. You know, people like the idea of all the kids in the neighborhood going to the same school, and there's a lot of benefits for that. Builds community, and the parents get to know one another, and the kids see each other, you know, at school and also on the weekends. And so that's fine. And in those schools, the schools have to do their best to try to find a curriculum and an approach and discipline and all of that that is more or less in sync with what the parents in that community want. And if it's a fairly homogeneous community with similar values and such, you know, it's somewhat doable. But maybe that's fine. You can say, look, there should be a standard school. There should be a school that, you know, works for most kids. But, you know, even in those kinds of affluent suburbs, there should still be an escape valve for parents who say, look, I just want something a little different for my kid. And if they can make it work, if there's enough of other parents and families that want something and they can make the scale work, go for it.
You know, I'd love to ask you just to change your language a little bit, because escape valve, I think, makes it seem like there's something wrong, and that for there to be something wrong, you need charters. And the idea here is that it doesn't say that there's something wrong with the district. It just says it's somewhat human nature that we do want some different options and different ideas. There's one other thing that really bugged me about this situation. The school, it's really difficult to run a charter and to run it well. And in a good district, that means that the charter, if the district is so good and people love it so much, they're going to have to convince a couple hundred parents mm-hmm. to place their child into a brand new school. To me, that's a pretty good test. That's not the only test. We want to see how well the school performs, but that's a pretty good test of whether the school district really is as good as it purports to be.
You know what I say to that? Escape valve. Just kidding. All right, topic number three.
On August 11th, Fordham will host Education Reform Idol. Which state do you think was the reformiest in the 2011 legislative session?
All right, so I'm really excited about this, Kevin. And again, I mean, talking about the ed sector connection, Richard Colvin is going to be one of our judges. You know, I'm not sure whether he or Jeannie Allen will be the Simon of the show in terms of being the most cynical. And
as long as he's not Paula Abdul, I think we're okay.
Yeah, I think we would all agree that he is not going to be Paula Abdul.
That's right.
And yeah, we're going to have folks in from Florida, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, one other state that I'm forgetting right now.
Indiana.
Thank you. Of course, Indiana. How could I forget? To talk about what they got done this legislative session. So do you think those are the right states? Do we leave somebody out? And isn't it interesting that most of them are in Republican-controlled states?
Well, you know, I would love to see D.C. in there. You know, as a D.C. resident, we're not quite a state, but we have a state office of education. I feel like you should have let D.C. compete there.
Oh, what legislation did they get done this year?
Well, and this gets to my point. Legislation is only the first start of the battle.
All right. Come on. That's unfair. All right. So, okay, get your parochial concerns out of the way for a moment. I support statehood, yada, yada. But look, come on. What do you think? I mean, Illinois, are you impressed with the Illinois teacher thing, or has that been oversold? Indiana seems to be a very much a favorite going into this, that they have pushed the envelope on choice, on teacher stuff, collective bargaining. I mean, across the board, a very aggressive agenda. Can anybody touch Tony Bennett in the state of Indiana?
Well, you know, Indiana and Illinois are probably going to compete on the more moderate side of your voting pool. But, you know, Wisconsin is way out there and Florida is way out there. You know, it's going to be a tough call. I think Illinois will probably come home winning with your voters, just the fact that they've accomplished a lot and with a little less acrimony, though there have been some issues in the last week or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there have been indeed. So I am curious, do you think any of these states have been strong on online learning, digital learning? You cover this a lot. Any states deserve kudos on that front this year?
So Florida is definitely trying to recapture its leading position. They've opened up their system in a really interesting way. They've had the largest public virtual school, and for a while they had this, they'd had full-time enrollments, but only the districts, each district contracted with the provider. It was kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. So they've opened that up. And what's really interesting, I think the most interesting thing is that Florida Virtual School, the public school there, which is by far the largest virtual school in the country, has said, bring it on. Let's open it up. Let's let private folks compete with us. I think that's an interesting development.
A vote for Florida. There we go. Okay, good. Well, that is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for playing, Bill. Josh, thank you. It's now time for everyone's favorite, Daniela's Research Minute. Daniela, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we talked about this beforehand. This is actually your second appearance doing Research Minute.
I believe so, yeah.
How'd the other one go?
It was pretty good. Rick had me on a stopwatch, though, so it got me a little flustered.
Yes, and you were just an intern back then.
Oh, those are the days.
Okay, well, let's do it. Amber's on vacation, but you're going to bring it. What are we talking about this week?
So this week, we're going across the pond. We're looking at a paper published by researchers Helen Ladd and Edward Fisk in the latest Journal of Policy Analysis and Management, documenting the effects of weighted student funding in the Netherlands and what the Dutch lessons might mean for the U.S. The Netherlands has been using a version of weighted student funding for all students ages 4 to 12 for 25 years. Ladd's and Fisk's analysis focus on Amsterdam, Rotterdam, The Hague, and Utrecht, the four biggest cities, as they can better be compared to U.S. demographics than the other places in the country. Here are the findings. The schools in the highest weight index category have 58% more teachers per pupil than those in the lowest weight index category. That being said, schools in the high weight index categories score significantly worse on the Dutch School Practices and Policies Index, which evaluate things like efficient use of class time, having a rigorous curriculum, and the collection of and use of data to monitor student progress. There's a lot to unpack in the paper, and it's a bit of a mixed review for weighted student funding, but it does offer some interesting implications for the U.S. We're generally trying to keep within time, so here's one big one. Teachers in the Dutch system are paid based on a lockstep national salary structure, meaning that the high-weight schools couldn't recruit the best teachers with higher salaries. So if weighted student funding is to work in the U.S., the authors infer, we'll need to make sure that it's coupled with autonomy over hiring practices for schools.
Very interesting. I like that. Wow. All right. So let's understand this. So the higher weight index, this is basically our schools serving more poor kids, I assume. Is that most of the weighting around poverty?
They weighted around two things. They weighted around not poverty, interestingly enough, but whether parents were well-educated or not, mm-hmm. and whether the parents were immigrants. Hmm.
Yeah.
And they actually ended up changing that in 2006 because people got a little iffy about weighting based on immigrant status, and they weighted thus really only on parent educational attainment.
Right, which, you know, researchers will say is the best marker for socioeconomic status,
right,
that you've got. You've got those, you know, poor graduate students out there who throw this all off because they are low income, but they are highly educated. All right, so so that's interesting. So basically, the schools with more more kids coming from lower SES, mm-hmm. they get more money, but they're not, but they're more inefficient, and it sounds like maybe not performing as well.
Right.
So the money, so they're getting more money, but it's not leading to greater equity in terms of outcomes.
Or
management of schools. What do you think, Bill?
I think it's really fascinating, and I want to read the study now because it does get at this, how to use more money more effectively. Mm-hmm. And this is the debate here in our country about, is it just more money or is it perhaps being more effective, or in some cases both?
Right.
And this study is obviously pointing to the both in many ways. It's not saying the more money didn't help, but it is saying that you need to put the more money with some other practices that might be more right. effective.
What's fascinating to me is the politics of this. I mean, can you imagine the United States if wealthy school districts were told not only that you're going to spend less money than poor school districts, and you are not allowed to tax yourself to spend more, but that you have to pay your teachers the exact same as they're making in other places. I mean, we are used to suburban districts being in a kind of arms race to raise teacher salaries to get the very best people into their schools. And, you know, they've got the money to do it. So it's interesting, the politics of this, you know, the sort of those communities just accept that, you know, they're not going to be able to compete in that way. Makes me curious about how the other dynamics, I mean, how many wealthy parents opt out of the public system altogether, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep. They've only got about 30%. I mean, it's a different school choice model than we have here, but they have about 70% of students go to some sort of choice private type mm-hmm. school, and about 30% that stay in the public, you know, true district type public schools.
But the funding system works.
The funding system works right.
Hmm. I mean, what do you think, Bill? I mean, am I wrong to be worried about this? I mean, do you think we can get to the point where affluent communities would be willing to say, yes, we're not going to tax ourselves out. We're going to accept, if we had an equitable school funding system, that we're going to accept that if we get $10,000 from the state, and we're just going to make do with that, even if we wish we had more?
I think that's always going to be tough because local communities are going to want to have the opportunity to provide more for their children if they can. I think that's a different conversation to say, well, let's equal everybody up by like capping the top districts mm-hmm. and kind of closing the gap that way. It's a different thing to say, you know what, and this is the way many state finance systems do, let's give greater weight or let's give extra to poor districts rather than sort of capping.
Though there are some. I mean, Kansas right now, there was a court case recently we covered in Education Next where, you know, the state law basically does cap what the local districts can spend and says, this is what you get, and you cannot go above that even if you want to tax yourself. And the parents were saying that was they were being deprived of their rights, 14th Amendment rights, et cetera. And the court said, no, I mean, the state law can basically do that. Not many states have been willing to do that instead. All right. So, Daniela, where are we going with this on the song here? We've got weighted student funding in the Netherlands.
This is going to be good. Well, so because we're talking about the Netherlands, we've got Dancing in the Streets by Dutch-born Eddie Van Halen.
Reaching for that one. Nice.
Sweet.
Bill, I'll admit it, I had no idea that the Van Halen brothers were actually born in the Netherlands.
No wonder they brought David Lee Roth on.
Ah, yes. They needed to have their American bona fides.
Exactly.
We've used the term bona fides now, I think, 3 or 4 times in this broadcast. 3. Why is that? Are we worried about our bona fides? Bona fides.
You know, you started off the whole phone hacking scandal. I think it's been, you know, we've been really sort of trying to maintain our integrity and our bona fides.
Yes, there you go. Do you think it's kind of uppity when people say bona fides?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, enough on that. Now it's time for lots of people's favorite, Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What up with that? Yes,
sir. Chris, welcome back to the show.
How's it going, guys?
Enjoying this beautiful weather we're having?
It's a little hot for my style, you know, being from Michigan and all, but yes. I'll take it.
Yes. Are you hot under the collar about something this week?
Well, the ridiculous news from the education world has been rolling in rather slowly during the summer months, but fortunately for us, this well never runs dry. A recent study published in the Teachers College Record finds that a stunning 43% of grades issued in college are A's. The study, which surveyed a wide range of colleges and universities, finds that number up to 12 percentage points higher since 1988, and 28 percentage points higher since 1960. On the other hand, less than 10% of grades were D's and F's. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for a greater percentage of students to fail, but seriously, just shy of half of college grades are A's? What's up with that? To be fair, this study isn't pointing out something that hasn't already been identified. Why is this happening, though? It must be that our students are slow-rolling the NAEP and PISA exams during grade school, waiting until college to start throwing down A's and to reveal how they've actually been incredibly bright all along. Or maybe it's because in the highly competitive world of professorships at colleges and universities, professors need to do whatever they can to retain their teaching positions. Sadly, course-end evaluations weigh heavily on the overall evaluation of the instructor. Yet, these are usually filled out hastily and are only indicative of student satisfaction with the relative ease of the class, not the instructor's quality. If all evaluations work like this, we'd live in a cakey country where nothing would get done and nobody would work hard. But everybody sure would be nice all the time. We've known for a while now about the problem of grade inflation at the post-secondary level. It's time to do something about it.
All right, now see, I would think that a lefty like you, no, I'm just kidding, I'm not really lefty, but they would say this is a case of market failure, right? I mean, you know, if you're a college student, you have a lot of incentive to go to some place where you can get a prestigious degree with the minimum amount of work. And, you know, maybe colleges know this, and professors certainly know this. If they want people signing up for their class, they're not going to be the person who gives mostly B's and C's and D's.
So I had a conversation last week, and there may be a solution to this. I learned that college professor evaluations are now collected by a central system where they can be sent from all over the country. And so it's not just comparing the individual instructors against one another, but they can now look across hundreds of institutions and compare the teacher evaluations. So, for instance, that organic chemistry class, which I'm sure the ratings are always terrible because it's always a really difficult class, we can now look and compare those against other organic chemistry classes. So we can begin to look at the teachers whose grade inflation is matching their evaluations.
Mm-hmm. See, I want to dig in on this a little bit. Like, I'm curious if the higher end, more expensive colleges have even more grade inflation than the others. You would think that that's probably the case.
The study did find that.
They did find it. Okay. So, and now you could interpret that a couple of ways. One is those schools are quite selective, and therefore they have great students coming in, and they are students know how to do school, and they do well, and so they deserve those higher grades. The other is that they're paying a lot of money, and people aren't going to, you know, they expect if you pay a lot of money and, you know, you do some nominal work that you should be able to get a decent grade and graduate on time. I bet that if we looked at high-end high schools in this country, private high schools, where people are paying money, you'd probably find the same thing. I mean, people are paying money, and to say that I'm paying money and I'm getting D's must say that the school is not doing what it needs to be doing to help me. I think the only real solution to this is to say there has to be a forced distribution. We're only going to allow 20% of the grades in any class to be an A.
Yeah, that's always going to be a difficult one to put over, particularly in one of those colleges where the students do come in and they're doing absolutely really well. Some of this gets to, in some ways you were saying that the professors want to have high evaluations to help their tenure. I think it's actually less about caring about high evaluations. It's that more rigorous classes are more work. And we actually don't value teaching nearly as much in post-secondary as we should. And that would help quite a bit.
Well, I think from here on out, we should have this policy, not only for colleges, but I think for Fordham and Ed Sector. We should say in our own evaluation systems for our employees, we should say, look, only 20% can get the highest rating. And another 20% can get, and we just force it that way. I don't know. I think suddenly we would really see where the chips will fall.
That's right. I'm sure that would definitely improve productivity in my office.
And morale, absolutely.
Okay. Morale, yes.
We'll give you an update someday about how that went. All right. Bill Tucker from Education Sector, thanks for joining us. Chris, as always, thank you. Till next time.
I'm Bill Tucker.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.